This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Live from Toronto, Canada, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium, and congratulations, you found us. Perhaps just in time. Come on in out of the dark and the wind and the cold, grab a stool by the fire and warm yourself. You are among friends. You're listening to this radio program, which means you weren't able to attend my live event in Oshawa tonight, Follow the Truth 2. It was an amazing time. We had a great turnout. We had people who came up from Los Angeles and New York. One person flew in from England just for the conference. If you missed it, don't worry. I'm going to be doing more, and the next one will likely be in Toronto, one in the summer maybe, perhaps another one again in the fall. Just check out the website, followthetruth.tv, and we hope to see you there next time. My story producer, Albert Vinzel, has posted some stories in the highlight carousel at richardserrett.com that I'm sure you'll find interesting, including a blog posting reposted by zerohedge.com that is, quite frankly, kind of chilling. It's called Signs That the Elites Are Feverishly Preparing for Something Big. What in the world are the elite up to? In recent days, we've learned that the New York Fed is moving a lot of operations to Chicago because of concerns about what a natural disaster could do. The U.S. federal government is apparently buying 62 million rounds of ammunition, commonly used in AR-15 semiotic rifles, for training purposes. And NORAD is moving back into Cheyenne Mountain because it's EMP hardened. In addition, government authorities have scheduled a whole host of unusual training exercises all over the nation. So, are the elite doing all of this in order to prepare for something really big? Or should we just chalk all this strange activity to rampant government paranoia? That's just one of the stories you'll find posted in the highlights carousel at richardserrett.com. And while you're there, make sure to sign up as a member. It's that blue button, the members area blue button just to the left. And once you're a member, and it's quick and easy and free, you'll have easy access to past shows. You can listen to past episodes of The Conspiracy Show dating back to July 2012. Thanks to Eric the intern for his great work on the website. On tonight's program, lots of headlines the last couple of weeks regarding medical marijuana and the proliferation of medical marijuana clinics and dispensaries in Vancouver. They now have 80 dispensaries. That's right, 80. One commentator estimated Vancouver now has more medical marijuana dispensaries than it has Tim Hortons outlets. Calgary is getting its first medical marijuana clinic this month. Here in Toronto, we have about a half dozen dispensaries and more clinics opening up across the city. The number of Canadians authorized to use medical marijuana has been skyrocketing. In 2002, a year after the government first permitted access through Health Canada regulation, 500 patients had registered. Today, get this, there are more than 50,000. 50,000 medical marijuana patients registered. So, I thought we'd spend the next 45 minutes or so discussing medical marijuana, the new federal regulations, and take a look inside and see how it all works. Ronan Levy is the entrepreneur behind Canadian Cannabis Clinics and Canvas RX, the country's leading medical marijuana specialized clinics and counseling services. Hey, Ronan, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
I'm very well.
Excellent.
Let's first clarify the new rules regarding medical marijuana. It used to be that patients were growing their own. What's changed?
What's changed is two big pieces, actually. So the first one is under the old regime, which was known as the MMAR, Patients who were prescribed medical marijuana could either grow it for themselves or they could appoint someone to grow it for them. And so you had people growing for themselves or had a whole series of small producers. And generally speaking, those small producers were not terribly well regulated. And the other piece under the old regime was that to get prescribed, you actually had to go to Health Canada to get permission and to get authorization to possess medical cannabis. Under the new regulations, two big changes. One is Health Canada is no longer involved in the process of prescribing medical cannabis. It's all with your doctor. So any doctor in Canada who feels comfortable doing so is actually perfectly legally capable of prescribing medical cannabis. And the second big shift is that production is now been diverted to a series of licensed producers. So basically the government has gone ahead and created criteria and very strict regulation of who can be authorized to grow medical cannabis. And so far there's been about 20 licensed producers who have been authorized, but there's been thousands of people who have applied to become these licensed producers. But you need a lot of money, a very secure facility, and very close adherence to some very strict regulations and procedures in terms of how you grow, virus count, mold, all that kind of stuff, to make sure that the end product, the medical cannabis that's being delivered, is as close to pharmaceutical grade as you can get when you're just actually growing a plant.
You're trained as a lawyer, and now you're an entrepreneur. You've had a number of interesting startup businesses. Why medical marijuana? Were you an activist first, or did you just see this as a niche as a business venture?
Yeah, I'm definitely not an activist. I am fairly libertarian in my views when it comes to drug use and recreational drug use, and respect people to make people's decisions for themselves and treat everyone as an adult. So I'm okay with it as a concept and people using either cannabis recreationally or medically. But my interest in it was partly purely entrepreneurial, just seeing a great opportunity to build a business. But as a personal niche, I've really worked in industries that tend to have reputations that tend to be sleazy or places that people don't necessarily want to associate with. And what I like to do is go in to these industries and bring a level of integrity and authenticity, because a lot of these industries actually have a lot of value and can help a lot of people. And right now in medical cannabis, you have the situation where it has the power to help, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Canadians relieve suffering from chronic pain or a number of other conditions. But there's still a perception that if you use medical cannabis, you're just using it as a front for, legal recreational use, that it's not really medical. And I want to change that perception. I want to help people understand that this is real medicine. It can help a lot of people live much better lives and is a better alternative, particularly when it comes to chronic pain, than the opiates that are out there. There's a lot of damage caused to society by people who get addicted to Percocets and other opioids, and cannabis provides a very natural, relatively safe, it's not perfectly safe, but a relatively safe alternative that can provide a lot of pain relief and help people who are suffering.
Let's start talking about Canadian cannabis clinics, and then we'll talk about Canvas RX. Canadian cannabis clinics, let's start with that.
Yeah. So Canadian Cannabis Clinics is a series of medical clinics. We now have four in operation, one in St. Catharines, one in London, one in Ottawa, and one in Etobicoke, just outside of Toronto. And they are medical clinics. When you walk into it, it looks like any other doctor's office that you'd walk into in Canada. It's staffed by doctors and medical office assistants. And what we do is we specialize in assessing people for prescription for medical cannabis. Under the guidelines from the Canadian College of Physicians and Surgeons Ontario and other colleges across Ontario, the people who should be receiving prescriptions for medical cannabis, it's a fairly narrow subset of people, and they want the people who have tried conventional treatments. So if you suffer from chronic pain or glaucoma, they want to see that you've gone through and tried conventional treatments, i.e. what you would normally expect your GP to prescribe for you. And if that doesn't work, then that's when you start to consider medical cannabis as an option. But even then, you know, there's a number of other things that may indicate that you're not actually a suitable candidate for medical cannabis. And that's what our doctors do. So you come in, you check into the doctor's office, just like any other doctor's office, and then our doctors will assess you. I mean, we'll do basic physical in terms of taking your temperature and your blood pressure and all that kind of stuff to make sure that you actually have the physical strength and stamina to actually be a cannabis patient. And then, you know, there's a whole other series of, you know, questions and things you've got to go through to see if you actually qualify. For example, if you have a history of addiction, you're probably not going to be prescribed medical cannabis for the obvious reasons. But that's essentially it. By the time you finish seeing our doctor, if you're a suitable candidate, they will prescribe medical cannabis for you. And it's just like a doctor's office in every other respect like that.
So do you then sort of act as a liaison between one of the licensed growers or producers of medical marijuana and the patient?
Yeah, so Canadian Cannabis Clinics doesn't do that specifically. We actually have a service that you mentioned before, Canvas RX, that does that. So after you see the doctor, if you are prescribed, then you sit down and talk to one of our cannabis counselors. And I should note that all of these services are provided for free. So when you see a doctor, it's covered by OHIP in Ontario, so you don't pay anything. When you sit down with our cannabis counselors, it's provided for free, so you don't have to pay anything either. And our cannabis counselor will essentially do a lot of the stuff that you would expect to have a doctor provide to you, but doesn't necessarily make sense for a doctor to spend that time with you because they can serve their time better seeing other patients. So the cannabis counselor will teach you about medical cannabis. They'll teach you about how to consume it. So obviously we don't recommend that people smoke it because of concerns around cancer and your lungs. So we suggest that people vaporize it, which heats the cannabis up to a temperature below the combustion point, but at a high enough point where the active chemicals, THC and CBD, and there's a whole bunch of others, but those are the two primary ones, get released and can actually be inhaled so you can consume it. If you're not a candidate for smoking, we'll teach you not a candidate for vaporizing. So if you have emphysema or something along those lines, we'll teach you how to, you know, make teas with it, make butters with it. So you walk out of the appointment well-informed about what you can do with it. We also help you select a strain. So there's 17 licensed producers in Canada who are selling to patients right now, and all of them have between 5 and 20 different strains that they're selling. So there are a lot of
options. Let me just jump in, Ronan. Excuse me. I do want to pursue that. I want to talk about how you match strains to particular symptoms and diseases and so forth. We'll do that when we come back. Ronan Levy is an entrepreneur and one of the co-founders of Canadian Cannabis Clinics and Canvas RX, the country's leading medical marijuana specialized clinic and counseling service. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show right here. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
We are back. Ronan Levy is with us. Canadian Cannabis Clinics and Canvas RX. Again, we're talking medical marijuana. You mentioned the, was it 17 licensed medical marijuana producers across Canada?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm fascinated about the various strains of medical marijuana or the cannabis plant and how you are matching those to a patient's particular symptom. Tell me more about that.
Sure. So what we do right now is if a patient is prescribed, they sit down with one of our cannabis counselors, and the cannabis counselor will help them understand the options that are available across Canada. So there's all the different producers with all their different strains. And, you know, right now, because it's not a pharmaceutical product, it doesn't go through the double-blind placebo testing that all pharmaceuticals go through, there's a lack of information in terms of what strains are best suited for you. And so what our counselors do, they take the available information. Many of our counselors actually are medical marijuana patients themselves, so they're extremely familiar with it. And we present the options. There's different ways to categorize medical cannabis. You can look at whether it's sativa or indica. You can look at the THC percentage, the CBD percentage. The producers have different characteristics. So some are organic, some are more, you know, tried to create in a pharmaceutical kind of environment and all that kind of stuff. And we help patients really drill down to figure out what may be best suited for them, because it's not like a pharmaceutical product where we can say definitively that this strain of medical cannabis will treat your glaucoma well. It's a little bit of a test and response. Try these few strains, which other patients have used very well and found good relief using these strains. And if it works for you, great, we'll keep you on it. And if it doesn't, well, the next time you come back in 3 months to renew your prescription, we'll try out some new ones to find the ones that work for you best. Even though right now there isn't a lot of science that exists for each individual strain within Canada.
I would guess it would be largely anecdotal at this point.
It's exactly largely anecdotal. There is a good amount of evidence to say that, broadly speaking, cannabis is effective as an effective therapeutic option for pain or glaucoma, generally speaking, as cannabis. But for specific strains, it's still a little bit unknown. And so every time a patient comes back to us and sees our doctor again, we actually ask them to complete a very extensive survey to find out if it worked, find out if side effects and, you know, any other information that we think may be relevant, to really make the selection less of an art and more of a science. And so, you know, we've helped thousands of patients now, and now we have a very significant database to say, okay, we've seen 60 patients who have come in for glaucoma, and we've found that 58 have found this particular strain highly effective. And so we're trying to build that database of information that can really start to drill down. So we know if you're coming in, you know, if you're a single, a white male, you know, who's 50 years old and coming in for this, we can say like, okay, white males that we've seen of this age group have found this strain very effective. And so it's not perfect science, but it's getting a lot better than the anecdotal information that's typically been relied on to this point.
And granted, you're not a botanist or a horticulturalist, but how are these strains being developed? I mean, can you give me a sort of a glimpse into that whole process?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ultimately, cannabis is a plant, and so there's many different strains that have existed all around the world for, you know, millions of years, and some of them have been cultivated for the black market over the last 100 years or so. And so a lot of the producers have started with the black market strains. If you're at all familiar with the marijuana black market, you'll recognize names like OG Kush and AK-47 and all that kind of stuff. And so they took those strains, and now, you know, applying modern growing techniques and hybridization, they're taking those strains and trying to create new strains that have different profiles based on their THC, on their CBD, their terpene profiles. In Canada, the producers aren't really required to talk about the terpenes, but the terpenes are the hundreds of other chemicals that give a lot of flavor, and I don't just mean that as in taste, but in terms of the experience that one has with medical cannabis.
Right, because it's not all about the THC, right? I mean, that's what gets you the high, correct?
Yeah, THC is what gives you the euphoric high, and that's what most recreational people, recreational users are looking for. CBD is being hailed a little bit, probably overly so, as a bit of a cure-all, because it has anti-inflammatory properties, has anti-pain properties, it has anti-nausea properties, and it does it all without getting you high. So
right.
There are some strains in Canada that have virtually very little or virtually no THC, and between, you know, 8 and 14% CBD. So you can actually smoke it or vaporize it or consume it and not get high, but still get the benefits of it, which is great for, you know, professionals out there who can't go to work high because it actually impairs their judgment, but they want the benefits and the relief that comes from medical cannabis regardless. And so there's a lot of effort being put into focusing on CBD, extracting CBD, even though in Canada extracts are still technically illegal. We expect that they're going to be made legal somehow or in some way, and it's particularly in the U.S., CBD is a big focus right now in terms of extracts, because you get a lot of the benefits without some of the, some people like the side effect of getting high, but if that's not what you're interested in, then you can actually get the benefit of medical cannabis without the high.
Now, if, let's say, for example, you're undergoing chemotherapy.
Yep.
Which, you know, can obviously do a number on someone's appetite, et cetera. First of all, someone who is undergoing chemotherapy, would they be a candidate for medical marijuana?
Absolutely. Coincidentally, my mom was going through chemotherapy about 4 or 5 months ago, and she was a successful candidate for medical marijuana. And so absolutely, obviously, against, particularly with cancer, we're very cautious against people smoking it. So we strongly encourage that they vaporize it or find a different way to consume it. But it, it can be extremely beneficial. It doesn't cure cancer, although there's some people out there who suggest it does, but scientifically, at least as far as we know, it does not. So, but it does provide a lot of pain relief. It does stimulate the, your appetite, so you can actually eat, which keeps your strength up, and it just helps you get through what is, you know, what now I've witnessed firsthand is a truly awful, awful experience going through chemotherapy.
And is it the THC that is the appetite stimulant in that case?
You know what? I'm not entirely sure off the top of my head. I think both THC and CBD have an impact on that, but I can't say for certain.
And what are some of the other, I think you mentioned glaucoma, or maybe not, but I would imagine yep. glaucoma is certainly something that can be treated with medical marijuana. What are some of the other ailments?
Yeah, so the patients coming through our clinic, pain in any number of forms is definitely the most common. About 60% of our patients come in for chronic pain, arthritis, whether it's rheumatoid or osteo or inflammatory. That's by far the most common. Then anxiety and depression are very common conditions that people come in looking for medical cannabis for. MS and the spasticity associated with it, chemotherapy and cancer, multiple sclerosis, if I didn't mention that one already. Epilepsy is another common one. We have seen, not too many, but we've definitely seen some pediatric patients whose parents have come in because their kids suffer, you know, seizures hundreds of times a day. We actually have one patient who came in, her mom and him came in. He suffered hundreds of seizures a day, and this was back in October, and ever since being prescribed medical cannabis, I think he's had maybe one seizure since, and it's really given him a quality of life that he never had before.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is obviously very controversial whenever you talk about, you know, administering marijuana to children. I saw a, I believe it was a 2020 yep. on ABC, and a couple in New Jersey where until very recently they were not permitting, I'm not sure exactly what the holdup was, but Governor Chris Christie was not going to pass into law this a particular medical marijuana bill. So this couple was forced to take their child to Colorado and locate there permanently because their child was having multiple epileptic seizures, as you say, every day. And in this particular case, again, it's anecdotal, but the turnaround was absolutely, the transformation, remarkable. What can you tell me about the science or the present research in terms of medical marijuana treating epilepsy in children?
Truthfully, the science is kind of exactly where all other science is in respect of cannabis. There is basic elemental science that says cannabis can be an effective treatment for seizure disorders like epilepsy. In terms of drilling down to say, I don't know if the specific story you're talking about is the Charlotte's Web story that people seem to be
familiar with. That's the plant. That's the actual plant that has been developed.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, there are not nearly enough controlled scientific studies to actually say effectively in a scientific manner that this is an effective treatment for epilepsy. That being said, there seems to be a lot of anecdotal evidence out there to suggest it may be a very effective option. And you know, it, anytime you're administering any drugs, whether it's a pharmaceutical or if it's medical cannabis, there's always risk associated with administering drugs to children. I think the perception around cannabis, you know, in light of its history over the last 100 years, makes this particularly shocking. It sounds like feeding your kid vodka or something along those lines. It sounds like something you don't do, except it is much different. And that's exactly what we're trying to do at Canadian Cannabis Clinics, is trying to change the perception that this is, in fact, medicine, and it's good medicine, and it's natural. And as with every medicine, it has risks associated with it, particularly in pediatric patients. I mean, there's science out there that seems to suggest that people who use cannabis on a frequent basis under the age of 25 really increase their likelihood of having psychological disorders later in life, schizophrenia in particular. And so it's definitely an option of last resort. It's not something you want to try at first, because there are potential consequences associated with it. That being said, if you're without option, it's definitely a, anecdotally at least, an effective choice for some people. And so I understand why there's outrage when people administer marijuana to their children. I think that outrage is in part fueled by perceptions, the still negative stereotypes around.
I agree. You know, where is the outrage? You know, how many hundreds of thousands of people die every year from prescription drugs?
Absolutely.
And they're taking them properly in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the outrage there? It seems to me there's just the hypocrisy here. You know, the double standard applying it to marijuana when. You know, how many people have died, from taking the occasional toke?
Absolutely.
It's really, and it's interesting how it's come full circle, isn't it? Because there was a time when you would find a vial of cannabis oil in just about every doctor's little black bag.
Mm-hmm.
When did that change?
I think it changed in the 1920s or 30s, right around the same time as Prohibition came and went. There was a big push towards eliminating any vices in society. Who knows why the prohibition on alcohol actually, you know, it probably is because alcohol is extremely much more addictive than cannabis. And so when you took that away, you had a lot of very angry people who wanted to push through prohibition, whereas, you know, the consequences of alcohol consumption tend to be addiction and much more aggressive behavior. When it comes to cannabis, it doesn't create aggressive behavior. Typically, it can. It's not 100%. But, you know, the general result is people are fairly relaxed and fairly content. And so you didn't have the same level of outrage because you didn't have the addiction. You didn't have that push. You also didn't have that societal integration when it was criminalized back, I think it was in the 30s. And then, you know, the government did a very good job, you still see it today, creating this perception of reefer madness. And even though, you know, in polls across Canada and the U.S., most people are open to legalization, at least with respect to medical marijuana, even possibly recreational, there's still a very insidious perception that people who use it for medical purposes are just recreational drug users looking for a legal way to get access to it. And it's so unfair. And it's unfair to paint them with the blush of the typical stoner, of, you know, a lazy person who sits in their basement eating Doritos. You know, one of the things we're trying to do right now is really put a real face on this and say, like, no, this is your neighbor. This is your friend. There's lots of people out there who are very successful, very professional, and who use medical cannabis to help them, you know, get through life because they're suffering from some chronic condition.
Well, as state by state, you know, medical marijuana legalization comes on board, the tide is definitely turning, and it's just a matter of time. Ronan, stay put. We'll come back and talk some more. Ronan Levy is the co-founder of Canadian Cannabis Clinics and Canvas RX, the country's leading medical marijuana specialized clinic and counseling service. Back with more right here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away.
Different views make great conversation. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. To speak to Richard live, call 416-360-0740 or toll free in Ontario, 1-866-740-4740.
We're talking with Ronan Levy, Canadian Cannabis Clinics and Canvas RX. Now, Canvas RX, tell me about the database. You alluded to it a little bit earlier, but what exactly, what is this database all about?
Sure. So when a patient comes through and sits down with their counselor the first time, we help them select a strain. When they come back a few months later, typically our prescriptions are written for about 3 months, just in good medical practice to be prudent and making sure it's working and it's not being diverted. When a patient comes back, they sit down and they sit down with their cannabis counselor, excuse me, and they're asked to complete, as part of the process, a fairly extensive survey. And the survey makes note of what they were prescribed, what strains they used, how much of the strain they've used, because very often, you know, anytime you get a prescription, sometimes you'll get 50 pills, but only end up taking 30. And that happens here as well. Cannabis is, unlike a pharmaceutical, you use it when you need it to address your symptom. And so sometimes that involves taking less than more. And so you fill out how much you've used, the strains, the impact, was it effective, were there side effects? And it's a lengthy survey that takes probably about 15 or 20 minutes to complete. And we take all of that information and we're compiling it into a database. And really the goal is to bring the level of science up to a much higher level than it's been. With so many strains, it's really difficult to get that level of granularity into the science. But because we see so many patients who come back frequently, we actually get a lot of opportunity to collect this database across all licensed producers. While each licensed producer is doing their own science on their own strains, you know, they only have 5 of the couple hundred that are now available in Canada. So we get a much broader perspective. And we work with a medical advisor, a group of medical advisors, one of whom is associated with the University Health Network in Toronto and St. Mike's Hospital. And he's taking this database and really trying to put it through rigorous science. So we're going to be releasing a preliminary survey of the results of releasing a preliminary study of the results of these surveys in the next month or so, talking about who the average user is, what strains are working for what kind of thing, and at a very high level. But we also have an application before the Research Ethics Board at the University of Toronto to go much further. So starting to get into double-blind placebo testing and really elevate the level of science, because one of the big restrictions around medical cannabis is doctors aren't willing to prescribe simply because they don't know enough and because the science isn't there. We're trying to provide the education. The education, I think, is coming a lot faster than the science, but the science is starting to catch up, and we really want to be on the forefront of that.
Those studies are expensive.
They are.
So, I mean, isn't that kind of the conundrum? Because when we're talking about big pharma, obviously, you know, there are billions and billions of dollars to be made.
Mm-hmm.
But with medical marijuana, it's not at that level, obviously, yet. So, and how are these studies to be funded then?
You know what, that's a good question. Right now, we're doing what we can with the resources we have. There are a lot of patients who are using it. I'm quite confident that medical cannabis is one of the fastest growing prescription medications in Canada. And so, you know, there's more and more data out there. And even though we're not necessarily doing double-blind placebo testing with it, we are getting a lot of feedback that we can, you know, show on a statistically significant basis its efficacy. It's not quite the same, but it's better than nothing. That's for sure.
And did you say that there are something like 200 different strains now of medical marijuana?
Yeah. Each licensed producer is getting their strains as their own brand. So, you know, one producer may have an OG Kush that's branded X, and another producer may have an OG Kush that's branded Y. And so, you know, on one level, they're branded differently, so we call them separate strains. On another level, they're the same strain because they're both premised on OG Kush. But on a deeper level, they're actually fundamentally different. It's in some respects, kind of like wine, that if you grow a grape in one kind of environment and produce a wine from it, you're going to get a type of wine. But if you take that exact same grape and move it across the country and then grow it in a different environment, you're going to have a very different wine that results. And so you have producers, even though they're producing the same street name strain, the actual product is going to be very different. So yeah, we're you know, in the neighborhood of 200 strains in Canada, even though some of them may have come from the same varietal, so to speak, they are actually very different.
All right, Ronan, we'll take one final time out, come back. A few more questions remain. Ronan Levy, Canadian Cannabis Clinics and Cannabis RX. Stay with us here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett.
Question everything. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. Shaking the world and seeing what falls. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Ronan, tell me a little bit about, give me a profile of some of these producers, 17 of them nationwide. First of all, I don't know, just sort of intuitively, I'm thinking many of them may be located out on the left coast in British Columbia.
Yep, there are some out in British Columbia. The majority are actually in Ontario. There's one in Manitoba right now, and I think one or two licensed in the East Coast. So Organigram is in Nova Scotia. In Ontario, you have licensed producers like Afria, Tweed is Ontario, Bedrican, Medrelief, a few others, and in BC, Tilray is the most well known. But there's also another one called Broken Coast Cannabis, and Canamed, which is in the Midwest, used to be under the MMAR. There was one grower authorized by Health Canada that was called Prairie Plant Systems, and they became Canamed. So you have the full spectrum. I mean, some of them are almost like mom-and-pop shops run by families. Others are very sophisticated organizations that have used the public markets to raise a whole bunch of capital to build out their facilities. And so you have the full spectrum of different business operators within the community.
I would imagine it would be, if one were interested in getting involved in cultivating medical marijuana, it would be a regulatory nightmare. How does one begin?
Yeah, it is a regulatory nightmare. It costs hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, truly to get into it. Even though there's 17 applicants who have been authorized, there were something like 1,000 applications received. And where do you start? I mean, it starts by downloading the application form and finding out what the requirements are. There are strict regulatory requirements in terms of who you are. So the principals in the business have to go through a series of approvals, RCMP approval and all that kind of stuff to ensure that they don't have criminal backgrounds. You need to have a grower who's going to be doing the growing for you. You need to have a facility identified. Many people build the facility before the facility is actually authorized. It costs millions of dollars to build that facility because it has to be of a certain scale if you're actually going to make this a business. But then again, you also need very strict requirements in terms of having a safe where you store the medical cannabis, in terms of having cameras and security systems to keep everything safe. Truthfully, the regulations have changed since last year when they first came out with them, because as more growers get authorized, Health Canada learns and adapts and changes the rules and usually makes them more cumbersome to make sure everything's secure. And so these days, most people who are considering it, the first thing they do is hire a consultant or a lawyer to help them get through the application process, because, if you drop the ball on your initial application, you'll just get struck out. There are too many applications out there that if you're not standing up, if yours doesn't look decent, then you don't have a hope in hell of actually getting authorized.
And who, I mean, there's probably not a sort of a typical profile, but what types of people are getting involved? Are they, for example, let's say former tobacco farmers or someone, someone that's been involved in agriculture that's looking for a new cash crop?
Yeah, it has been, absolutely. There are definitely some people who come from agricultural backgrounds, and truthfully, it makes a lot of sense because they know how to grow plants and do it on a large scale basis. So it's smart for them. Other people, Tweed, for example, up in Smith Falls, they bought the old Hershey factory, and they're doing it all indoors, and they brought in a grower who had experience. And so you have the full spectrum of people trying to do this in different ways. I've met other applicant LPs who have purchased you know, these standalone sort of greenhouses where they can actually control the humidity and the barometer and all that kind of stuff. So if they're growing a strain that was originally from the Himalayas, they can actually replicate the environmental conditions of what it would be like in the Himalayas to grow it. So there's a whole bunch of people coming at it from different avenues, from different backgrounds. A lot more than I expected are coming from a very scientific and modern industrial approach to growing it, as opposed to, you know, growing it in the ground. Almost all of them are in greenhouses. Not all of them, but a lot of them are in greenhouses simply because it tends to be lower cost than building it out in an indoor facility, but it's all over the place.
And what are the security requirements? I mean, is there a regulation or a manual that lays out how a facility is to be secured? The height of the fence, guard dogs?
There is. I haven't read it. I'm a busy person, and it's a long list of requirements that you have to meet in terms of being able to get a license. But I know the bar is set very high, and it's not cheap to comply with it. That's for sure.
But you have been out to one of these producers, I'm assuming, or?
I have, yes.
And what do you typically see when you go out there?
It depends, but there's usually a screening protocol where you have to check in and they, you know, confirm your identity, and then you walk in and you're never left alone, at least to the extent that you're near the actual growing plants or the products that have been cut. Otherwise, you know, sometimes they look like farms, as you'd expect. Other times they look like, you know, highly secure facilities where there's passcodes on every single doorway that you have to go through. It really depends on the circumstances, but all of them are very strict. Health Canada is doing spot checks on them all the time to make sure the security protocols are being followed. And so you're never left alone for very long if you're anywhere close to the actual cannabis. Otherwise, they're typically highly clean, very efficient, very, very nice facilities, as they have to be.
And how do they make their money? When the medical marijuana goes to the dispensary, wherever that is, for the patient to pick up, do they don't pay for the services to see the doctor, but do they pay for the actual cannabis?
Yeah, so, I mean, you raise an important distinction. So dispensaries in Canada are actually technically, with some exceptions, illegal. So when you do get prescribed, you can't actually go to a dispensary just like a pharmacy. You can, not legally, because they are there, but you shouldn't be under the MMPR. So when you do get a prescription, what you do is actually you go online or by phone and you register with a licensed producer, and then the licensed producer will ship it to you to your address, and that's how you get it. And how the licensed producers make money? Well, they sell the products just like any other pharmaceutical product. Prices range from $5 typically to $15 per gram. So it is quite expensive, and the real challenge, I think, for the industry overall is that unlike most other prescription medicines that will be covered by health insurance plans, there, with the exception of very rare cases, medical cannabis is not covered by insurance plans. So if you're paying, you know, $10 a gram and you're using a gram a day, it's $300 a month to kind of keep up with your medicine, which is a significant expense, given that most of the people that we're seeing are injured people. And so often they're on some sort of disability benefit because they can't work anymore and they're looking because of the pain that they're in. And so they're looking for relief, but it costs them a lot of money.
Well, has any consideration been given to the fact that if someone is, you know, using medical marijuana as opposed to, you know, taking their drug card and going to the pharmacy and getting far more expensive pharmaceuticals, which the government pays for in part, that this could end up, you know, saving the healthcare system in the long run?
Absolutely. I mean, we haven't run the numbers, but I think all of us internally believe that there's a huge cost savings to the government and society as a whole from medical cannabis, particularly vis-a-vis opioids. one of our medical advisors has come forth and said that even though opioids are the first-line treatment for chronic pain, actually cannabinoids should be first, and there's two reasons for that. One is opioids have a high risk of harm. Yeah, there's addiction, overdose. It happens way too frequently. And it's been shown that opioids after a year or so aren't actually very effective at managing pain. For cannabinoids, you don't have as much evidence to show that it is effective, but you also don't have the evidence to show that it's not effective. So it's more of an unknown, whereas it's a known non-effective product with opioids. But the point he raises in light of that is like there's very little harm. There's strong evidence that there's little harm of cannabinoids. And so if you could actually move a lot of those people on who are addicted to opioids or prevent people from going on opioids in the first place and moving them over to cannabinoids, you could save a ton of money to the health insurance systems. You know, there's a lot of methadone clinics out there trying to help people on who are addicted to opioids titrate off. If you don't have those people addicted to opioids in the first place because they started with cannabinoids, you have a huge, huge expense taken off the books of the health insurance plans in each province. It could be an incredible cost savings just in that category alone, let alone the other ones where the government is subsidizing, you know, very expensive pharmaceuticals with something that could be a very, not cheap, but very natural and very affordable product.
Are there enough producers to fill the demand?
Yeah, absolutely. excuse me. From an industry perspective, it's actually one of the challenges, which is because all of the colleges have come out against doctors prescribing medical cannabis because Health Canada has put a high, you know, threshold in terms of who qualifies. There aren't a lot of patients actually getting on board, not nearly as many, I think, as most people expected, but you have these producers who are ramping up supply. So supply is far exceeding demand right now, so there's no shortage. When the industry first launched about a year ago, there was a big shortage that because it was a plant and you have to, you know, grow and harvest a plant and that takes time. But now that the producers have become more efficient, have had a few cycles of harvest, they have lots of supply. So there's definitely no shortage in Canada for any patients who are looking.
But isn't it probably true, we're speculating here, Ronan, that the vast majority of people that are smoking for medicinal reasons, or not necessarily smoking, but whatever, making butter, et cetera,
yep,
are self-medicating and going through the black market? If they were to go through proper channels, you would have a huge influx of patients.
Absolutely. If they went through the proper channels and they actually met the threshold. So you have a lot of people out there who are self-medicating who, at least right now, given the guidance from the colleges out there, would never actually qualify to receive a prescription because either they have histories of addiction or whatever the case may be. And so even if they went to their doctor would say, I know you're self-medicating, I know you're smoking weed off the street, but I still can't prescribe you because if I prescribe you and something goes wrong, you know, that's my medical license that's out the door. And it just doesn't make sense for me to take that risk.
So they give an addictive personality, they'll put them on opiates rather than cannabinoids?
I know. I mean, obviously they shouldn't be, but it is kind of crazy when you think about that.
Absolutely. Sure. Ronan, I wish we had more time, but thank you for giving us some insights into the medical marijuana. Not only the industry, but your end of it, the research and the clinics and so forth. It's fascinating, and I applaud your efforts.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I'm happy to, you know, help people become aware of it. There's still a lot of misconceptions out there, and so anything we can do to remove those misconceptions and you know, help people find medicine that really helps them, you know, it's I'm happy to be doing that.
Quickly, leave us with a website.
Yeah, so you can go to cannabisclinics.ca or canvasrx.com. CanvasRx has a list of all the strains in Canada and a lot of reviews, and cannabisclinics.ca is just the website for our clinics. You can find out our locations and find out what you have to do to come see our doctors.
Thanks very much, Ronan.
Thank you very much.
The website for this program, richardserrett.com. As always, follow the truth.
Live from Toronto, Canada, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Thank you so much for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, your caravan, your RV, your earbuds, however you're listening in and wherever you're listening in. This is The Conspiracy Show, and it's a program dedicated to searching for truth. We never claim to find it necessarily, but at least we ask the right questions. I like to think so anyway. We're not doing an HOA this week, but we will start up again next week. I do want to thank Albert, my story producer, who's been doing such a great job with the HOAs, working on the show, booking shows, working on the website, also helping out with the development of the app, and I'll tell you about that. More about that in just a second. And thanks to Tim Spreen, of course, my technical producer, very capable, unflappable, always doing a tremendous job on the audio board and answering the phone calls. Eric, the intern, of course, also doing yeoman's duty. I'm so blessed to have such a great team working with me here on The Conspiracy Show, and also Moses Neimer here at Zoomer, very supportive. And Chris Whitting and the whole team at Syndication Network. The Conspiracy Show app I just mentioned, it's almost ready. And we'll make a formal announcement when you'll actually be able to download the app to your Android or your iPhone or your tablet. And then you can take The Conspiracy Show wherever you go. It has, I have to tell you, some amazing features. I am blown away by this app. Very excited. I've seen nothing like it. And a special thanks goes out to Sharon Forster, the app developer. What a great lady, and she's very talented. I look around what's going on in the world, and I hear the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, say things like this, that conspiracy theorists, that would be me and you, I suppose, conspiracy theorists are just as dangerous as ISIS. He actually said that. Now, he seems like a decent enough fellow, Cameron. For example, I really enjoyed his recent Easter message when he had the courage to stand up and announce that Great Britain is a Christian country. But when the Prime Minister of England, or Great Britain, says conspiracy theorists are just as dangerous as ISIS, I have to wonder how someone so incredibly dim can end up at number 10. He can't be that dim. No, I suspect not. Cunning like a wolf, methinks. The point is, Mr. Cameron is not alone in thinking that conspiracy theorists, non-violent conspiracy theorists, are somehow a threat, just as much a threat as terrorists. A number of members of the U.S. Senate, for example, have said similar things. Janet Napolitano, the former secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, the former governor of Arizona, who essentially believes anyone who doesn't agree with President Obama is a right-wing extremist. Anyone who supports the Second Amendment, even though, as I do, even though I'm not an American. Anyone who believes that gold is money. Anyone who believes that gold is money and not the useless Federal Reserve notes. Anyone who stores food reserves or badmouths the government in some kind of way is a homegrown terrorist. What I'm saying is, I can't promise you this program or programs like it will necessarily survive or be around for much longer. We are living in an age when asking too many questions will get you on a no-fly list or worse. So listen, enjoy while you still can. Wow, that's pretty dark and gloomy. Well, forewarned, forearmed. I have a young woman on the line here from here in Toronto. Erin Janis asks a lot of questions. She's a self-described survivor of our public education system. Amen to that. She's a popular blogger, videographer. In fact, many of her videos about food and water, chemtrails, social engineering, human rights have gone viral. Erin Janis, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. Wow, you have 30,000 subscribers to your videos and your articles. Tell me a little bit about your blog and your online videos.
Well, my blog and my online videos are a work in progress, but the direction I'm moving towards with it and the inspiration that I have to make my videos is a combination of basically a quest for truth that I've embarked upon after being really unsatisfied with my experience in the standard education system growing up, and then really kind of let down by the standard health system, our healthcare system, and just socially really unsatisfied and depressed with with society. And I just started to ask the questions, why? Why don't I fit in? Why are people depressed? Why am I depressed? Why are things so off? And I'm still learning and growing, but my online videos and articles aren't so much something that could fit into mainstream. I tend to talk about a lot of controversial subjects, from health and wellness to human rights, animal rights, and a lot of the things that are basically hidden from society and not talked about because it either conflicts with the interests of big corporations, big agriculture, or the people and companies who are basically pulling strings and profiting off of our society staying unaware and unempowered for the most part. And so my recent articles are exposing some common New Age misconceptions that I fell into during my quest for truth, and just working towards empowering people to take back their power and to educate themselves and to not simply go through, you know, life feeling unfulfilled and not knowing why. I encourage people to question things and ask why and realize that there are answers and we can know the truth.
Well, Aaron, you've arrived at the right place, because I like to think we do much the same here on the Conspiracy Show. Now, I do want to delve into some of the misconceptions about New Ageism, and I think you aptly point out there's nothing new about New Ageism. I mean, it's been around for millennia. But before we do that, because I know that you talk a lot about fluoridation in the water. You talk a lot about GMOs, chemtrails. These are, you know, three areas that we cover on the program. And I wanted to start with chemtrails with you and just get your a sense of where you're coming at this from. What do you suppose they, and we can discuss who they might be at some point, but what do you suppose they are spraying?
Well, from what I've researched and what I've learned, I can't identify exactly what it is, but there's enough evidence to say that it's a number of things, and it's not always the same kind of things, but definitely different chemical concoctions, which is why we call them chemtrails. There have been reports based on analysis and appearance by chemists and scientists and people who basically can't speak out in their fields or they'd be shunned and fired, who think that there have been concoctions of fungal, different types of fungus being sprayed into the atmosphere, molds, hazardous waste, different chemicals, aerosols, and there are many different hypotheses as to why they're spraying and what they're spraying, but there's no question about whether or not it's happening. Chemtrails are real, and whether you want to call it geoengineering, the, you know, modification of our atmosphere, or whether you want to call it poisoning of the population, chemical concoctions are being sprayed over the population, and it's a real issue. And the fact that it's still debated as to whether or not it's even chemicals is... and hazardous waste is scary. It's really, really scary because people don't want to think about it because it doesn't make them feel good. And that kind of ties into a lot of the New Age misconceptions that I've been recently talking about. And people need to take their blinders off and realize that just because something is horrible and awful and you don't want to believe it's true doesn't mean that it isn't true and doesn't mean that you should just close your eyes and you know, close off and plug your ears, because that's not just making you feel better. That's actually failing our future generations and leaving them to have to clean up the mess and them to deal with the long-term consequences, which we don't even know what those are yet.
Well, you're right about, indict the mainstream media in particular when it comes to chemtrails. And I always issue the challenge on the air that if there's a newspaper person or a news broadcaster out there who wants to win a Pulitzer Prize, they should do something on the chemtrail issue, because the fifth estate or the fourth estate, whatever you want to call them, have totally abandoned the playing field when it comes to this issue. People look out the window, they see this strange crisscrossing pattern in what was a beautiful blue sky, and within moments it's overcast. They call the city desk of the newspaper, and they get the phone slammed down. And I know people call me and they tell me what happens when they call the local news station. They just are not willing to countenance or even consider the possibility that there's something going on up there when the evidence, as you say, is overwhelming. When you've got aluminum and strontium being found in the soil in pristine wilderness areas like Mount Shasta, 10,000, 20,000 times normal levels. I mean, what other possibility could there be?
Right. And, you know, there's things that people will do to debunk evidence like that and say, oh, that's just runoff from mineral deposits and that's natural aluminum in the soil. Regardless of whether or not certain studies or certain investigations may or may not turn out to be related to chemtrails, the truth is chemtrails are being sprayed and it is affecting water, it is affecting soil, it is affecting the air that we breathe. And like you said, you know, people try to inform news stations and they try to get people in positions of authority to speak out about this, but we would be naive to think that that would be allowed or that that could just slip by and make it to mainstream media, because we have to understand that it's mainstream media is heavily controlled. Most of the really, really popular news stations that won't dare talk about this are owned by companies that are huge, huge companies and corporations. A lot of them, you know, we think it's the illusion of choice and we think that we're watching a variety of news, of popular news stations, but they're all owned by a very small handful of companies. And the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, we don't know what kind of ties that they have to this activity, chemtrails being sprayed, but we know that if it was some terrorist organization doing it, they would never, never get away with it. The security that we have in America and around the world is so... It's so high tech that there's no way that it's a mystery to the Central Intelligence Agency and a mystery to big companies and corporations with high security. There's no mystery about who's doing it or what's going on. So what we have to understand is that whoever's enforcing it and whoever's profiting off of it and whoever wants this to be happening, it's being hidden on purpose, and media stations are probably told and directed not to speak about it, because that's what we see in all situations where, you know, big agriculture or big companies and corporations are benefiting from something. You don't hear it being spoken out against on mainstream media. That's the way it's designed. And mainstream media, I'm not afraid to say it, most of it is a big, fat distraction. Most of it is a big, fat distraction, and you'll find that people who have been tuning into mainstream media for most of their lives have no idea what's in their food, no idea what's really going on in society, no idea how things are working, how their rights are being taken away, how their rights are being violated. They think everything's fine and dandy when it's not. We're living in times of, like, the worst destruction that has ever happened to our rainforests, to our water, to our health, to the air, to our food. And you tune into mainstream media, and you're going to hear some stupid, fluffy story about, you know, the local fundraiser and the local fire in Susie Thompson's house. And it's like, get real. You know, there's no transparency in mainstream media, and we need to stop believing that there is, because if there was, you'd be hearing about the fluoride in the water, you'd be hearing about the chemtrails, you'd be hearing about GMOs. There would be no debate about whether or not they are happening. The debate would be, why are they happening, what's in them, and what are the long-term effects?
All right. Erin Janis is with us, activist, online personality, singer, songwriter. Over 30,000 subscribers. Her videos and articles shed light on topics including fluoridation, human, animal, and environmental rights, spiritual rationality, social engineering, and chemtrails. We'll come back and discuss more with Erin Janis right here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. We're back with Erin Janis. Erin, give us a website.
It's erinjanus.com.
All right.
That's erinjanus.com.
All right. And we've also linked up to your website at richardserrett.com. Just click on Erin's name right there on the front page, and that'll take you right there. The why in terms of the spraying. I mean, I have my theories, but why do you think this, you know, we're being rained on with these aluminum particulates, strontium particulates, perhaps even some, you know, nanotechnology that may be involved in there. We can discuss Morgellons in a moment if you'd like. But why do you think the perps, are doing this?
I honestly can't say why exactly I think they're doing it. but I know that control has something to do with it. I don't know why exactly they may want to control or change or modify our atmosphere, but I know that as far as control of the masses and keeping people dumbed down goes, that is so prevalent in so many ways that I believe that would be a part of it. And, you know, a part of me doesn't really want to say that because I'm worried about what people might think. Oh, that sounds crazy. What she's saying is crazy, but I kind of just have to accept that I'm on your radio show and that your viewers, most of them are not in the debate mode of whether or not it's happening or whether or not there's mind control prevalent in our society. So I just kind of have to let go of that fear of just saying what I think is happening, because let's get real. Let's look around. There's control and dumbing down of the masses in so many ways today. I don't see why spraying over a population would be, a crazy hypothesis as to how to dumb a population down or to just weaken a population in general. If you look at the structure of this society, the powers that be, they have the real power, and most people on this planet live as slaves. And if the majority of people were healthy, happy, and conscious and aware and able to comprehend and understand what was going on and take control of their lives, society would be very, very, very different. Humankind would not be suffering to the degree that it is. Destruction would not be going on to the degree that it is. And the powers that be would not be in power to the degree that they are. Humans would be living the way that we should be, the way that we have the right to. And, I mean, there's no doubt about it. Spraying chemicals over a population is a crime against humanity. It's a crime to all life on Earth. And whoever is responsible, whoever is behind it, is not at all, I don't even want to call them human, because it's so psychopathic and sick to be doing that. That I don't even know how to comprehend what their agenda is, but I know that control has something to do with it.
Well, I have no problem, believing that there are people who are able to do this. People in high places, and you mentioned, psychopaths, and that's precisely really who is in charge. You have to be. The world is geared in favor of the psychopath. The psychopath rises to the top. The way our society is structured, it's by design. And you cannot become, you cannot be king of the hill unless you are a psychopath, unless you're willing to step on people below you and do whatever, and that includes the current occupant of the White House. In order to get that position, you must have psychopathic tendencies.
Right, and I don't remember who this quote is from, but it's something along the lines that it's not power that is what is corrupt, but that it's magnetic to the corruptible. And so within the structure of our society, how it's designed to have, authority figures and people in power and people without power, you're right. The psychopaths are drawn to that position. They, from a young age, psychopaths, some psychopaths who are born that way, they're drawn to controlling, and they climb their way up, and that's where we're at, and that's what we're dealing with.
Right, and also, I've been very public about this. I happen to be a Christian, and I believe that Satan rules this world. That's what the Bible tells us. It is evil exists, and that's who's running the show here. So we shouldn't expect anything less, really, from the people who make it to the top. Let's talk a little bit about, shift gears slightly, and this is another huge area of interest for you. It's also very controversial, and that's genetically modified organisms, GMOs. Now, one of the, you and I may have a slight disagreement here. I think that we have been genetically modifying organisms for thousands of years. Whenever my father used to graft one variety of rose onto another, and create, you know, different colored roses. Some people do it with fruit trees.
That's hybridization. When we cross-pollinate, that's hybridization. But genetic modification, which is going on now, it's something that's quite different from that. As hybridization happens in nature, has been for, you know, thousands of years, and is totally natural and normal to hybridize things and for things to sort of cross-pollinate and create something new. But in order to genetically modify the food the way it's being modified now, we're dealing with people in labs taking, you know, the genome of a pig, for example, and putting it into something like a tomato.
Okay. Let me ask you, though, about, and I agree that there are particularly those crops that are referred to as Roundup Ready. This is huge. This is a huge red flag, obviously, because we are ingesting these Roundup Ready plants, and, you know, it's being found in breast milk, and it's a huge problem. But I find that it tends to be oversimplified that anything that's GMO is bad. Let me give an example of something, and maybe you can disabuse me of this notion. But I look at something like tiger rice, for example. Now, blindness in children in the developing world is huge because of, you know, they're not getting vitamin A. So now you have tiger rice, which has been genetically modified. It's producing the plant is producing vitamin A, and now you have a chance of, you know, impeding blindness with children through this genetically modified crop. Obviously, rice is a huge staple in the developing world. How do you feel about something like that?
Well, I feel if there's a way to genetically modify something in a safe and effective way to, you know, enhance the vitamin A content of rice, for example, if there's a safe and effective way to do that, I don't see why anyone would be against it. But it's just that Monsanto and the leading companies who are genetically modifying foods, they're not transparent about what they're doing and how they're doing it. And a lot of the times the studies that we see about its safety or its effectiveness or, you know, how GMOs are not having a bad effect on bees or GMOs are not actually requiring more pesticides when they do, they're funded, you know, the pro-propaganda for genetic modification is funded by the companies that are creating the GMOs. And what we're seeing is that when people are eliminating GMOs from their diet, their health is improving. And another issue is you cannot reuse genetically modified seeds. So it's destroying our heirloom variety of food, which can be reused over and over and over again through generations. And I don't feel safe or comfortable with companies that are tied to so many injustices. A Monsanto, for example, if you just do a 10-minute Google search on some of the ties to corruption and just total criminal activity that this company has involved itself in and the violations towards farmers and
Environment. You'll forgive me if I have to jump in there and throw in a few alleged, because it would be irresponsible of me not to. The criminal activity is alleged, however, and the corruption is alleged. However, I'm not going to argue with you that there, you know, Monsanto has huge issues in terms of transparency. Whenever we have, I believe, the present food czar in the United States is a former Monsanto exec. So, you know, it's very problematic. Now the Terminator seeds, I don't believe actually have come on market. They are researching the idea of a Terminator seed, but I don't believe at present they're available, or am I wrong?
I'm not exactly sure.
The idea is that you'd buy a seed. You'd have to buy this. The farmer would have to buy the seed from Monsanto or Dow, which is also into this game now. But then that crop would grow and it wouldn't produce seeds. In other words, it's a terminator, so that you would have to keep going back to Monsanto each year. Obviously, typically a farmer would hold back a number of seeds each year so he could replant. But if you're growing their product, you're not able to do that because the plant isn't producing new seeds. That's the idea. At some point in the future, I don't think we have Terminator seeds yet. You know, rue the day when that comes.
Maybe I should have phrased myself better. There is no commercialized Terminator seed from Monsanto yet, but the genetically modified seeds that are used it's with all the pesticides that are required to continue using them. For example, many GMOs require more Roundup or are suggested to use more pesticides
right.
in their yielding. That poses issues for long-term successful farming when we're constantly destroying our soil, destroying the content of our soil. And like when people refer to GMOs as Frankenfood, Frankenseeds, I agree. Like I don't trust the long-term effectiveness of simply genetically modifying our food. I don't trust it. I don't think their interests are good. I don't think it's for the good of the people. And I have yet to find when a multi-million dollar company whose goal is profit and who have just caused so many issues, I have yet to find a huge corporation that is in it for the people and not for the profit. And when we're dealing with the food that's going to feed millions and that millions are going to rely on, and we're dealing with profit, that's so dangerous.
Well, that's where the GMOs are losing the game in terms of the efficacy. Monsanto's motto was, they want to feed the world, and the philosophy was that as the population grows, the only way we can feed the world is with GMOs, because they are claiming that the yield was so much better than traditional farming methods. But now we're finding out that has not borne out. It's not true. You do not get higher yields with genetically modified organisms or crops.
Yeah.
So score one for the traditional farmer, I guess.
Yeah. And there's the thing is, I don't like to simply jump on board with all conspiracy theories, but something that is interesting to consider is there's some literature out there that can be accessed quite easily regarding Monsanto having ties or patents on aluminum resistant genes. And like we were saying before, with aluminum being a common thing that would be in most chemical trails that are dumped into our atmosphere, it's interesting that there may be ties financially as to why Monsanto may be for genetic modification, for chemtrail spraying, something that they can make a genetically modified seed that is resistant to that.
That's
because
true.
If we think about the chemicals affecting our soil and depleting things and damaging how we grow our food, if Monsanto can, and then our natural organic heirloom seeds aren't surviving or thriving, Monsanto can just create something that's resistant to what they've been spraying.
Exactly. It's the alkalization of the soil through the aluminum, and they are producing alkaline-resistant plants that thrive, actually, in that type of soil, whereas, as you say, the heirloom plants do not do well. And so there seems to be a cozy connection between chemtrails and GMOs. We'll take a time out. Aaron Janis stays with us, activist, blogger, videographer, and environmentalist right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Aaron Janis stays with us. Give us that website again, Aaron.
It's just aaronjanis.com, and you can also find me on YouTube and Facebook.
All right. Let's spend a few moments talking about New Ageism, and you've got that squarely in your sights these days. What do you mean by New Ageism?
By New Ageism, I mean the most recent sort of evolution of spirituality, so to speak, that has sort of evolved with the uprise of social media. There's so many spiritual gurus that we can follow and find online and watch their videos and read their books. And when I first got into exploring the truth about, the food we eat, the fluoride in the water, corruption in society, I was also on somewhat of a spiritual path, like many people who pursue truth. And I fell into what I would call the New Age movement. And it was wonderful. It was amazing. And I would, at the time, a few years ago, I would have considered myself a New Ager, being a young girl, just trying to figure things out, looking for my spirituality. And what I've learned is that a large part of the New Age movement is basically like a net. It's like a trap. And if you fall into it, it will absolutely greatly reduce your ability to expand your consciousness, expand your understanding, because there are a lot of half-truths and total delusions within the New Age movement that I believe have been put there via social engineering as another way to stop people from reaching their full potential and their full ability to take back control of our lives and of our humanity and of our society. And what you'll find in the New Age movement, I'm not saying that everyone who's involved in New Age and spiritual practices are not in solid grounds. I'm just saying that there's a lot of crap out there that is simply not true that people run with. And that's what I found, and I try to speak out and raise awareness about that, because if I didn't take the time to see past that and have the help of researchers and public speakers such as Mark Passio, I probably never would have reached the level of awareness I'm at now, and I would probably still be trying to change the world with my thoughts and by trying to manifest a better world instead of taking action towards a better world.
Okay, give me a few examples. This is a shorter segment, so just give us a few examples, misconceptions regarding, or traps, as you say, regarding the New Age movement. Red flags.
Red flags. A big one is that there is no truth and that perception is reality and that there's no real way for us to discover the truth about things because it's all just too vast. This is flat out delusional, and although many people believe it, I encourage people to explore that we live in a very personal way. Although we live in a vast universe, we are living in a personal way on this planet, and the things occurring on this planet are very real. So not to get lost in the delusion that it's all just perception and that, you know, you create your reality with all of your thoughts. There's some truth to that, but that is in and of itself a trap if you don't have the logic to understand and differentiate between what is meant to be taken in one context and not applied to all things. Another one is what you resist persists. Something that's taught in the New Age movement more and more and more is that we need to stop resisting things and that resistance is a form of going against the flow of life. And this is just simply untrue. It needs to be called out. People need to understand that we need to resist evil. We need to resist corruption. We need to have positivity and peace in our lives, but there also needs to be a balance. For example, activists like Martin Luther King, or if you could think of any of your favorite activists who have created great change in the world, it's because they had resistance to something that they were uncomfortable with and something that was unjust. There's just so much I could say about it, but a couple other things is that there is no right and wrong.
Yeah, moral relativism.
Moral relativism, what a joke, what a joke. Moral relativism in its roots is a satanic view. And when I say that, it doesn't really matter if someone believes in Satan or not. Moral relativism is dangerous, and it allows people to create their own versions of what is right and what is wrong based upon their preferences. But the truth is we can define right and wrong actions, moral and immoral actions, and we need to stop believing the confused people who think that there is no right and wrong.
It's you're absolutely right. This is a major bugaboo I have. And one of the problems I have with, whether you want to call them New Agers who see the divine within or who are out-and-out materialists, as in atheistic, they have no concept of right or wrong because they don't know where it comes from. And I'm talking about inalienable rights. And if you don't believe in a higher authority, a creator, whatever you want to call that your creator, if you don't accept that you get your inalienable rights from the creator, then everything, your rights become privileges bestowed upon you by humans. And they can be given and they can be taken away. And this is a major, major problem we're facing, particularly in this province, where people have lost sight. They think if you talk to them about driving an automobile, oh, that's a privilege. No, it's not. It's an the right to transport yourself from one location to another is an inalienable right. And it's setting up a huge culture war, a generational culture war, people who have no concept where right and wrong comes from. We'll take a time out. Aaron Janis is with us. Fascinating discussion, and we'll do more on the other side. The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
The truth will set you free. But first, it will really tick you off. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Aaron Janis is with us, and we're talking about some of the red flags associated with New Ageism. We have time for a couple more, and then we can move on, because you've got so many things to talk about.
Okay, so a couple other things that you'll find within the New Age movement that are misconceptions, or you could even call them delusions, is to ignore the negative. And I do have to credit Mark Passio, researcher and public speaker, for a lot of these points. I discovered a lot of these delusions on my own, but he really solidified and explained that, you know, he calls out these things within the New Age movement, and he encourages people to spread the message and spread the awareness, and that's what I'm doing, especially with what I've learned after I considered myself to be a New Ager for a while. Another issue is to ignore the negative, because people in the New Age movement believe that what you focus on grows, and that if you put your attention on something that's negative, you're going to give your energy and your power to that thing, and it's going to grow like watering a plant. And like I said in my article, I don't know how else to say it, but that is delusional. Like, we need to be able to have the logic and reason to understand that, you know, as far as thought patterns go, if you're always thinking about horrible things, that's going to affect you emotionally, which can have an effect on you physically. But simply by being aware of injustices and horrors in the world, even, that doesn't give power to it. Being an activist and speaking out about it and raising awareness, that doesn't give power to an entity. In fact, it does the opposite. To be aware of what we're up against and to be aware of the injustices going on in the world make it harder for those things to continue, because when people are aware and people have good hearts and they care, they do something about it and they demand change. They create change. They put their foot down. And the powers that be and the dark forces that are controlling this planet right now, so many people aren't willing to accept that, and they can just go back to bed and think about ponies and rainbows. The dark forces that are controlling this world do not want people to think that it's a good idea to talk about what they're doing and expose injustice. They want people to believe that what you focus on, if it's negative, you give power to it, and that's not true.
Exactly. Their greatest power over us is despair. When we start to despair and give up and just accept everything, like Howard Beale in Network in that immortal rant when he's talking about, we know things are bad out there, but just leave us alone in our living rooms with our steel-belted tires. Have you ever seen Network, Aaron?
I have. And, you know, to just paint the positive thing, you know, focus on the bright side. When we're looking at, like, injustices on levels that are so horrific, you can't paint it something that it's not unless you're willing to go into a delusional state of mind.
Right.
You can't look at something horrible and think about it in a positive way. You just can't do that.
Lack of awareness. It's true. Lack of engagement in the world. Now, I don't want to sound like an old a fogey here, and I know that every generation tends to harangue on the younger one. But this is something I've been witnessing teaching part-time at a community college. And that is young people, very smart, very talented, otherwise very capable, walking around with their earbuds and listening to their iTunes and so forth. But never before has there been a generation that has had the world at their fingertips with the technology, and yet at the same time, never have I seen a generation so disengaged from what's going on all around them. Given the state of the world, where are the protests? Where are the protest songs from the musical artists?
Right. Well, that's just it. We're bombarded with propaganda and what we see in the media. The thing is, media is raising this generation. I'm 20 years old now, and my generation and the generations being born now are being raised in part by the media. And so what they see successful people doing and what they see, you know, hear in mainstream music, see in mainstream media, That's just how they operate. It's how their brain is being wired, because we're introduced to media all the time at such a young age now. If they don't see activism and awareness as being, you know, what the norm is and what successful people do, they're not gonna know how to do it. We're not taught in school how to think for ourselves. We're not taught how to think for ourselves at all. We're taught to simply listen to what we're told. And what are we told? What are we told with what we hear coming out of most radio stations, in most newspapers, most magazines, billboards? not much of any importance at all. And I, unfortunately, the only reason that I'm aware of things that are going on is because I was so unhappy and I was suffering so much. And I saw how things were so, you know, music didn't cut it for me. Putting my earbuds in my ears didn't cut it for me. I went to school and I was unhappy and things were off. I came home and I turned on the TV and I was unhappy and things were off. So I had to get to a point where all I was left to do was either get into addictions like most people do when they're unhappy or question why. And I asked why and why and why. And there are answers and they're not always pleasant, but pursuing truth is one of the only things we can do to change the world and to make it a better place. And it doesn't mean it's easy, doesn't mean it's not scary, but we need to do it if we want a better world.
You mentioned how many young people fall into some sort of an addiction, and Marshall McLuhan, you know, the greatest media mind ever, talked about how technology, and you mentioned social media, which is part of the technology, does a number of things. One, it erases our identity. Two, it takes us out of our body. You know, we're online now, on average, young people, 8 hours a day, 8 hours a day in front of an a tablet or a laptop or an iPhone. And what happens is we tend to leave our body. Our minds are out there in the ether. And then drug taking is an attempt for us to get back into our body. So I think there's a connection between the rapidity of the development of technology and drug use.
Yeah, and not only that, but, you know, drug use and addictions of all kinds. Addictions that are not necessarily drugs, but addictions to certain distractions and just addictions that lead to an unfulfilling life. A lot of it stems from people, you know, you'll talk to a lot of people who are simply depressed and unhappy. They feel like something's missing, or they know that something is wrong, or they think the world sucks. And it's like, I encourage people to not suppress that with, you know, whatever your habits are that help fill that void or make you feel better. Question why and why and why, and ask questions. And if you don't go crazy learning the truth in the process, you're likely to be empowered. You're likely to be empowered with knowledge and realize that you're a human being with the ability to affect real change in the world. And there are so many issues that need attention, and pick one and you're set for life. Like, there are so many battles that need to be fought here. And people, I just encourage people to question things more often and search for the truth. And that's the danger. That's the danger that I'm trying to raise awareness with about the New Age movement now. Because you ask questions, and there's the answers, but they're not always true. So we need to keep using our minds and using our logic and reason, and try to understand, you know, things from a very logical perspective.
You're 20 years old, did you say, Aaron?
Yeah.
20. Wow. What do you see yourself doing in 10 years?
Well, I really love music, and I really love to play music and sing, and it's a great outlet for me aside from my direct activism and writing. So within 10 years, I hope to be doing public speaking as well as performing music and writing, and I'm really into the arts, so that's where I'll be.
And in terms of activism, do you have any political aspirations?
I do, but I don't want to act like I'm not guilty of the fear, because I've seen and I've watched what happens to a lot of people who gain a following and are in the spotlight, whether they're celebrities, either locally or globally. They speak out about stuff and they either get silenced or they get killed. So I'm trying to take things slow, and I'm going to do whatever I can to raise awareness about the issues that we've spoken about today. From human rights, environmental rights, and even animal rights, that's a big thing for me as well. I'm not sure how I'm going to go about it, but I'll use whatever medium I can to raise awareness.
But have you considered the idea that politics is the last place one would venture into if they were interested in making a difference?
I don't know. It really depends on a number of things.
I mean, I guess I've become quite cynical in that regard. I consider myself to be a political atheist. I do have political philosophies, and I have ideology, but I do not subscribe to, you know, the parliamentary system or political systems. I think it's rigged. I think what we have we have a one-party system. We have three leaders that are all vying to be the CEO of the corporation.
Oh yeah, and I mean, as far as that goes, for anyone who still votes, I don't know what to tell you. When I think about voting and when I think about looking up to politicians and people within government, you know, as individuals who can affect change within that platform, it's really difficult for me. You know, voting, it's like giving a PlayStation controller to a toddler with no batteries in it, and they think they're doing something. They think they have a say.
That's an excellent analogy. Listen, I wish we had more time, Aaron. I've really enjoyed talking with you. I hope you'll stay in touch, and we'll have you on again sometime.
Great. Okay. Sorry, the time flew by. I didn't know that we were already up at an hour.
It always does. It's aaronjanus.com, E-R-I-N-J-A-N-U-S, aaronjanus.com. And good luck to you, and keep up the good fight.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right. My pleasure. Aaron Janus. That's it for us. Another night has come and gone. My thanks, of course, to Tim Spreen, Albert and Eric, the interns, all of you listening at home. And don't forget the website, richardserrett.com. Say hello on Twitter, @RichardSerrett. Back with a brand new program next week. Hope you'll be on board. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.